Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, all you wonderful people out there in the dark. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. Oh, I can't go on. Can't tell you how much it means to know that after all this year, you're still here ready for more. I'm your host, the greatest star of them all, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is a man who knows a good face when he sees one, screenwriter and film historian, Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome.
Hi, that was a good imitation.
So good.
That was hilarious.
So good.
And there will be many more years to come. You don't have to make a comeback yet.
Yes. Well, hopefully my uncanny Norma Desmond impression has already made this very obvious. But just in case, on today's program, we're going to talk about the 63rd greatest film of all time, Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. I know we're skipping ahead a bit on our list, but since this is the first Sight and Sound entry of 2015, I want to make sure we start this new year off right. And is there ever a wrong occasion to celebrate the greatest, darkest, most caustic Hollywood satire ever made? I think not. Plus, Joe happens to know a thing or two about this Wilder character. Joe's interviewed the man, he's written about him, and not to mention, he teaches a class on Wilder's work that was once TA'd by yours truly. After Sunset Boulevard, we're going to move on to another subject in which Joe is extremely well-versed, the work of Orson Welles. Joe has written three books on Welles, and has recently acted as the series consultant for the New York Film Forum's Welles Retrospective, which is going on right now. We're going to talk to Joe about Welles' filmography, his legacy, and why 2015 is shaping up to be an exciting year for all you Orson fanatics out there. Then we'll close up the show with a brief recap of all the other projects that Joe's been working on lately. Okay, Professor, are you ready for your close-up?
Yeah.
Then let the cameras roll! This August will mark the 65th anniversary of one of my favorite movies of all time, Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. If you haven't seen the movie, please just go watch it. However, if you've seen it and you just need a little refresher, here we go. Sunset Boulevard is the story of an aging actress's descent into madness, as recounted by a dead man. The movie is narrated by the dead man, Joe Gillis, played by William Holden, who tells the whole rotten tale of how he ended up a floating corpse in a rat-infested pool in a dilapidated old mansion on Sunset Boulevard. Gillis, before he met his demise, pounded the pavement and his typewriter, trying to sell spec scripts to movie studios. However, as I'm sure listeners are aware, show business can be brutal, and Gillis, despite his best efforts to pander to the basest and laziest tastes of the American public, can't seem to give a story away. His Hollywood dreams are rapidly falling to pieces, plus, to make matters worse, he can't pay his rent, and he's got a pair of tenacious repo men on his tail trying to take away his car. Gillis is at his wit's end, and has pretty much resigned himself to finding a bus back to Ohio. However, those bill collectors aren't going to let him go so easy. Before Gillis can make his escape to Union Station, he finds himself on Sunset Boulevard in a medium-speed auto chase with the repo men. During the chase, he blows a tire and turns into the first driveway he sees. This is where the real story begins. The driveway leads Gillis to a mansion owned and inhabited by Norma Desmond, played by Gloria Swanson. Norma Desmond was once a great motion picture star, but has long since outlived moviegoers' attention spans. She has been cruelly discarded and left in utter isolation to stew in her resentment and her memories. However, Nora isn't content to continue withering on the vine. She believes she's still got stories to tell and an adoring public to return to. So when a young writer stumbles down her driveway and offers to provide a few notes for the script that she's been writing, it feels like kismet. Poor Joe should have seen it coming. The moment Gillis careened into that driveway, nay, the moment he bought that greyhound to La La Land, his fate was sealed. In Wilder's vision, Hollywood is a giant, shiny, enticing spiderweb. Many are lured into the biz by promises of fame and fortune, and no one, not the background players at Central Casting, not the executives, not the directors, not the waiter wannabes, not even the greatest stars in the world, leave with their heads intact. And poor, soppy screenwriters are especially doomed. Before long, Gillis is ensnared by Norma and made into her precious little dolly. And when Gillis refuses to play nice, he pays the ultimate price. that's the basic gist.
I think that will get people to watch the film. Yeah, that sounds really appealing. In a macabre way.
Exactly. Yeah. If that's the sort of thing you like, which I'm absolutely on board for. Like I said, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. But is this, Joe, is this one of your favorites?
Oh, yeah. It's always been, it's a movie that means a lot to every screenwriter. Because the hero we can all relate to as screenwriters is this struggling guy. And, I think one of the most wonderful things is that it is very unusual to have a dead man narrate the film, although American Beauty copied that. But it allows him to rewrite his story one more time.
Right.
It gives him another credit. He's writing the script, in a sense, which I think is a nice gesture to this guy. And it's funny and it's sad. But Wilder kind of got into that in an odd way, that originally the film started with his body was picked up and taken to the morgue in downtown L.A., and while he's lying there, people start sitting up in the other gurneys, and they start telling the stories of their lives, and they say how they got in there, and they ask him what happened to him, and he starts telling his story. There's a little boy who drowned, and Holden says, well, I drowned too, and there's an African-American guy, and there are other people. And so it's kind of funny, sad opening, fantasy opening. And then he says, well, let me tell you what happened to me. And then he goes into the narration. But what happened was Wilder showed that at a couple previews, and people thought it was terrible. They laughed in ways they weren't supposed to. So they had to cut that. So that's why that odd opening started. But it's a film that meant a lot to me way back in Wisconsin when I was just starting to be a screenwriter before I came to California. And I thought it was a little too cynical, too negative toward Hollywood, because I was, I love Hollywood in a sense. Sidney Skolsky, the columnist, used to say, don't get me wrong, I love Hollywood. But what I say sometimes is, don't get me wrong, I hate Hollywood. But at the time, I thought, oh, this is too, all these movies about screenwriters having a hard time in Hollywood, these guys are whining and full of self-pity. And then I get out to Hollywood and very quickly realize this is like a documentary. It's completely accurate. And I said that to Wilder, and he said, well, it's a Valentine. I love that. From his, he could have put much worse stuff
right,
in it.
Right, right. So he felt he was being generous.
He was being generous, yeah. And, he had seen it all. And then he said, every industry has this kind of slush under it. He said the oil industry and, journalism or sports or whatever, you could make a movie like that about any of them. And he mentioned Network was a film that he thought was kind of similar to Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
But it was about television.
Right, yeah. So did Wilder have any real-life inspiration for the Norma Desmond character?
Some people have mentioned there are some famous parallels to some extent. At one point they mentioned Rod LaRock and Vilma Bankey, having parties by their swimming pool and stuff. And there is no direct correlation, although there are many silent stars, of course, whose careers collapsed with the coming of sound because either their voices weren't right or their style was seen as too ornate. What makes a film interesting, one of the things, is that she's only 50 years old, Gloria Swanson. So Norma is this woman of 50, and there is a line in there where Holden says, well, there's nothing wrong with being 50 unless you try to act like you're 20. But what makes it poignant is that she's a representative of a dead art form. And today we watch silent films, at least some people do, and we care about that period. But in 1950, hardly anybody cared about silent films. They were hard to see. A lot of them were thrown away or burned or whatever. There were very few places, theaters, that would show them. We didn't have Turner Classic Movies, et cetera. So,
how did you live?
Yeah. Yeah. It seemed like an ancient history. I mean, even though it was only 20 years removed in time, it was like another eon. So she seemed like a representative from a distant past.
Right.
And that's what makes it sad, because she's not ancient.
Right.
And And yet she lives kind of in this cocoon of the past with this house that's surrounded by pictures of her, and it's this old-fashioned house, and she has her former director as her butler,
right,
her
right.
former husband, right. Eric von Stroheim, who is a real representative of that period, and she plays bridge with what Holden calls the waxworks,
right.
And Wilder casts three real silent stars, Buster Keaton, Anna Q. Nielsen, and H.B. Warner. And so there's a lot of resonance of the history of Hollywood was still very present.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood, I'm sure, was full of people who mm-hmm. couldn't adapt when the sound age began.
Or the industry rejected them for
some
reason that, you know, like Gloria Swanson, Wilder, one reason he cast her was that she had that kind of florid acting style.
Right.
He didn't want her to be ridiculous, but he wanted her to seem different from the modern people, so she kind of acted in that grand style that was pantomime,
right?
Which was a different acting style, but a wonderful, you know, some great, great performances in silent films. She's wonderful if you see Manhandled, for example, a film that Alan Dwan directed with her as playing a regular working girl in New York, just going through all kinds of struggles. It's a delightful movie. They showed that at the Academy some years ago, and people just loved it. So she was a great star, but she had this grand persona. She did some, you know, she did the Max Sennett films, and she did some Average Girls and all that, but she also did some grand vamping on screen, and she was married to a marquee, and she would go around in these big cars, and, you know, she lived the grand style. There were other actresses who did the same thing, like they would walk around with a leopard or a lion or something. And, you know, it was a different era where people were very outrageous.
A better era.
Yeah. So she represents that whole thing.
Right.
Which is different from the drab modern Hollywood that he portrays of office suites and things. You know, like when Eric von Stroheim, when they go to Paramount Pictures, he points up at the writer's offices on the second floor of this building, and he says, that was my dressing room, the whole second floor.
Yeah.
You know? It was a different time. You
right,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did these people who were once very, very famous feel about the way they were portrayed in Sunset Boulevard? I mean, we talked about Gloria Swanson, Max von Stroheim, Buster Keaton makes an appearance as...
Yeah.
A waxworks figure.
Yeah. Well, they're not all on record talking about it. Stroheim, Wilder admired Stroheim a great deal. His two big influences were Ernst Lubitsch and Eric von Stroheim, and he said his style is a kind of funny blend of both of them. Stroheim was a great director who had been ruined by Hollywood. He was famously extravagant and would shoot, you know, go over budget and make films like Greed that was 5 hours long in the version that he wanted to exhibit it. The rough cut was like 8 hours long, but he was ruined by Hollywood. So he's in the film, and he was in another Wilder film, Five Graves to Cairo, before that. And when he came on the set, Wilder assembled the cast and crew and said, I just want you to know that Mr. von Stroheim was always 10 years ahead of his times. And Stroheim said, 20. he was prickly. I guess they had a few run-ins, and he had a lot of ideas for Sunset Boulevard, some of which Wilder included, but he wanted to do a scene, like he was the guy who thought of Max, the butler, is writing her fan mail, which is a wonderful touch that he keeps the illusion in her mind going that she has a lot of fans, but he's writing all the letters, and he tells Joe Gillis, I wouldn't look too closely at the postmarks, you know. But he wanted to do a scene where he's washing her underwear very gently and lovingly and everything. And Wilder thought that was, even for Billy Wilder, that was too kinky. But I don't know, I would have liked to have
That's
seen that.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. So I don't know what Buster Keaton thought of it. He looks kind of sad in the film.
Right.
Gloria Swanson, her career was, she wasn't really completely out of touch. She had a television show in New York, early live TV show. It's kind of like a chat show that she did, like people like Dinah Shore would do those things later,
right,
Oprah and people like that. It was kind of one of those shows, and she was, it gave her kind of a new lease on life. Her film career didn't really resume very much because she was then typecast as Norma, unfortunately. So she kind of hoped she would get a lot of different parts. She was in a few films later, but she didn't just sit around and feel sorry for herself. She was wealthy and she took care of herself, and she was still kind of a celebrity of sorts. So she's not exactly Norma Desmond.
Right.
You know.
Right. So the aging starlet drama is sort of a genre unto itself. And within that genre, there's a couple subgenres. There's the genre that allows the lead character a lot of dignity. Like, I'd put All About Eve in that category, or Opening Night, the Cassavetes film. And then there's the ones that revel in the grotesqueries.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Yeah, Mommy Dearest.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for this kind of movie. So, but do you, which genre, subgenre would you put Sunset Boulevard
well,
in?
It's, as you've suggested, it's sort of a blend of these things. Mm-hmm. Norma has great dignity and grandeur, and you admire her and you kind of like her, but she's also kind of crazy and she's a bit ridiculous. But Wilder didn't want you to laugh at her, but she is full of herself and she's striking poses and she doesn't realize she's out of date. One of the most poignant scenes is when they go back to Paramount and she's trying to sell her script to Cecil B. DeMille, and he has to gently break to her that they're not making the kind of films that she wants to do.
Right.
She wants to do Salome, which is kind of an old-fashioned thing. Although one of the ironies is he's making Samson and Delilah,
right, yeah.
which is the same kind of movie,
right.
And it's kind of a really ridiculous movie, but it did very well at the box office. But they're all kind of condescending to her. But he's very kind and gentle to her, and he had directed her in The Silent Period, too. And he was not the nicest man in the world. He was
right. How did he walk away so clean from this?
Yeah. Well, Wilder was being very generous to him. I think, you know, when he said it's a Valentine, I think that's an example.
Right. Let's talk about how the film straddles the line between reverence and contempt for the Hollywood studio system. We talked about how DeMille is sort of given. Wilder shows him a lot of respect in the film, and yet I'm not sure that everyone else is afforded the same respect. Do you think the movie is fair to Norma Desmond and people like Norma Desmond?
I think she's very likable, but you know, you have a distance from her. It's like a lot of Wilder characters. He's sometimes he's accused of being misogynistic, but I think he basically just sees men and women the same way in terms of they both have flaws. He's not sentimentalizing women like some directors do. So therefore, some people think, well, he must be misogynistic because he's showing a woman with flaws, or, you know, she's venal or she's corrupt or something. But his men are corrupt too, you know.
Right.
Women in his films are just people with flaws and strengths just like everybody else, but she's a special case. She's a kind of extreme example of a character who's in a privileged position. She was once one of the great celebrities, and now she's forgotten, which is a very cruel thing. Hollywood is a very cruel place.
I mean, I guess the question is the joke on Norma, or is it on... Is Wilder punching down or up, basically?
Well, I think, yeah, it's very sympathetic to Norma in that sense, because you feel her humiliation and you feel the injustice, and maybe even more today than people did in 1950, because we understand the silent films were a great art form. I think films sort of peaked in 1927, is my view.
Yeah.
I think the 20s was really the greatest decade of the art of cinema.
Mm.
Just fabulous work, very advanced and wonderful things. And I mean, I love the 30s and 40s and all that, but, you know, there was something, people have often pointed out the irony that the art of cinema sort of peaked and then it silent films ended right after that.
Right.
Because 1927, they made Sunrise and films like that, and then it was all over the same year.
Right, exactly.
And Mary Pickford had a great line. She said that it would be more natural if silent pictures grew out of talking pictures instead of the other way around, which is very profound, I think, you know.
Mm.
And she was offered the role of Norma, they had trouble casting Norma, and Charles Brackett, Wilder's collaborator, and Wilder went to see Mary Pickford at Pickfair and started telling her the story, and then they realized that it just wasn't right. She was an alcoholic, and she was a recluse, and for one thing or another, Brackett kind of looked at Wilder, and they both kind of exchanged the look, and then they kind of wrapped it up, and they also considered Paula Negri, and they called her on the phone, but she had this very heavy Polish accent. You know, she was one of those stars who didn't couldn't go on in films because of her accent.
Right.
And they considered Mae West, actually. They were going to have it Mae West.
That would have been perfect.
Yeah,
although Gloria was perfect.
I think Mae West would have made it too comical, you know.
So speaking of Charles Brackett, Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett were known as the happiest couple in Hollywood. Was that the case?
Well, Charles Brackett was an older guy, and he was an American, natural-born American. Wilder was an immigrant, and Brackett was a WASP. Very different kinds of people. Brackett came from old, distinguished American family, and his ancestors were in distinguished positions. And he was the drama editor of The New Yorker, and he wrote novels, and he was part of the Algonquin Roundtable. I mean, the guy had quite a pedigree.
Yeah.
And he came to Hollywood in the early 30s, and he didn't like it too much, and then he went back to New York, and then he came back. And in 1936, Paramount teamed them, which was a brilliant teaming. They were complementary in that Brackett was kind of quiet and austere and dignified, and Wilder was this pepperpot kind of guy who was just brimming with ideas and very irreverent and very clever. And but he always felt, since English was not his native language, I mean, he was from Galicia, which is now part of Poland. He grew up in Krakow, Poland, where his father had a hotel. Then they moved to Vienna. Then he moved to Berlin to be a newspaper man, and then he fled Hitler, and he went to Paris. So he was in exile several times over, which helped enrich his view of the world. He was very cosmopolitan, but he was always insecure about his English, especially in the early years, where he was having some trouble. You know, he learned English by listening to the radio, listening to sports and other, you know, commercials and things like that. But he wanted a collaborator who was good with English. So they worked very well together. And they were both great at structure, which is a big part of screenwriting. Brackett was very good at that. And we don't have the drafts of all the scripts to know exactly who did what, but they worked together very closely. They would sit in an office, and Wilder would stand. He was very restless. He would pace around all the time. But Brackett didn't mind that. Brackett usually was lying on a couch with a pad of paper, and he would write it down, and then they would talk things through at great length. And a lot of talking compared to the amount of writing that was done. But they had a lot of differences. One that was well known was Double Indemnity. Brackett thought it was a trashy and horrible novel, and he wouldn't work on it, really. Although it turns out he made some contributions, but Wilder hired Raymond Chandler to work with, and they had problems. There's a new play called Billy and Ray, all about their relationship.
Ah.
And then Brackett, he had some problems with Sunset Boulevard, but he also thought Ace in the Hole was a horrible idea.
Really?
That was a film that Wilder did after Sunset Boulevard, and Brackett didn't want to work on it, so Wilder basically fired Brackett and parted company.
How was that? No law. They got a divorce.
Yeah, Brackett was shocked, he said, that you know, for many years, you know, these quotes, Brackett said he was shocked and really bereaved that Wilder just dumped him, and he never got over it. He kept going. He made films. He won an Academy Award for Titanic in 1953, which is not a very good film. But so he never really made very good films after that. However, a book came out recently that Tony Slide edited Charles Brackett's diaries, which the family had made available to him. It's called "It's the Pictures That Got Small," which is a quote from Sunset Boulevard that Norma Desmond says.
I think you can say it better than that, don't you? It's the pictures that got small.
It's the pictures that got small, in quotation marks.
Yes, of course.
Charles Brackett and Billy Wilder and Hollywood's Golden Age. And it's a fabulous book, really interesting. But it reveals that Brackett was complaining bitterly about Wilder from almost the beginning. many complaints about arguments they had, and he was offended by all kinds of things. And there were a lot of political arguments. And what it reveals is, most significantly, is their first big argument was over the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in 1947. Wilder really didn't like that at all. He was a liberal Democrat and believed in civil liberties very much as an immigrant, and he'd been through the Nazi era, and he knew what that kind of thing could lead to. And Brackett was a Republican who they got into an argument about Dalton Trumbo refusing to cooperate with, and he was blacklisted, of course, and Brackett was attacking Trumbo, and Wilder got really angry at him. And Wilder said, according to Brackett's diaries, "I don't want to work with you anymore."
Wow.
But what's interesting is for about 3 years, they keep threatening not to work with each other. But even before that, Brackett is saying, years before, he's saying, "I don't want to work with this guy anymore. This is it. This is the last script I'm going to do." And then he always comes back and does another one. So they kept working together until finally Wilder had had it. And then he just said, you know, "We're not going to," he very calmly said, "We're just not going to work together anymore."
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was not all his doing. Brackett was complaining about him at great length for years.
Funny.
And so, they had all kinds of, and, you know, I think, you know, there's an interesting disagreement. My editor at Variety, Tom Pryor, who was a New York Times reporter, told me once he thought Wilder's work deteriorated after he left Brackett. And he worked with I.A.L. Diamond on many films, who I think was a great screenwriter. And Wilder's films became more bawdy and raunchy, and some people would say vulgar. Tom said they were vulgar, you know. That's a word that sometimes people use for Wilder.
Right.
And he said that Diamond was bad for Wilder because he encouraged Billy's vulgarity. He said Charles Brackett was this dignified, conservative guy, and he said he restrained Billy's tendencies.
I'm a pretty big fan of The Apartment.
I think Wilder's later work is just great.
Yeah.
And I love Kiss Me Stupid, which is the raunchiest of all.
Right.
The Apartment is a great film, and Diamond and Wilder wrote that. And I asked Wilder, I gave him the Career Achievement Award from the LA Film Critics in 1995, and I had lunch with him and Jack Lemmon. I mean, at the lunch. Hanging out with those two guys. And I said to him there, I said, "What do you think is your best film?" And he said, "The Apartment." And I said, why? And he said, "I think it's the best blend of comedy and drama I ever achieved. It's a perfect blend of that," which is true.
I completely agree.
And it was considered a dirty fairy tale, it was called, by Hollis Alpert at the time. And Wilder was offended by that. And then he later thought, well, that's a pretty good description of the film.
Yeah. Actually, since this will be the first Sight and Sound entry that we have in the new year, I was thinking that The Apartment might have been a good one, given that it is one of the few New Year's movies that I really like.
Ah, yes.
But
yeah, Christmas and New Year's
Christmas
are both
and New Year's
skewered in the film.
Exactly.
So I like those later films a lot, and I think the Brackett films are good. Sunset Boulevard, you know, is a great, great film. But I think there's a certain restraining influence that Brackett had on Wilder, which I don't particularly think is good.
Mm.
You can't complain about some of the other films, but I think that Diamond let Wilder be Wilder in a sense. And they were more similar, that he was a Romanian Jew, and so he and Wilder had more in common.
Yeah.
And they also had this bawdy sense of humor in common, which Brackett definitely didn't have.
Right. So, final question on this topic. Sunset Boulevard is the 63rd greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll, which you took part in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that is a good place for it?
Well, I mean, that poll, like all polls, should be taken with a grain of salt,
of course.
You know, how do you rank greatness? You know, I have a lot of films that I think are wonderful and that I keep watching over and over again, and Sunset Boulevard is one of them. I never cease to find it fascinating to watch. I never get bored with it. And the same with Vertigo and Kane and many other films in that list. And then there are films in the list that I'm not fond of, but that's part of the whole thing, too.
Right.
So I don't... I mean, it's great that it's 63rd is pretty high on that list. It means that it's still viable with a lot of critics and filmmakers. As I say, young people like that film. When you show it to them today, it really connects with them.
I agree that the film it still feels relevant. It still feels, the satire still holds up. It still feels like it has teeth, even after all these many years later. And the performances are terrific. Obviously, Gloria Swanson is amazing.
She's really iconic. Yes. She's one of the great iconic characters in films.
Exactly. And I'm going to go ahead and say 63rd is way too low.
That's true. It should be.
That should be number one. Exactly. Yeah. It's in my personal top 10.
That's good. I think I put Some Like It Hot on my list.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to, you know, it's hard to pick 10. And I kind of figured, okay, who are my favorite directors? I'll pick one by each.
Right.
And then I did put two Orson Welles films on. But with Wilder, I think Some Like It Hot is just a perfect, fabulous film. It's probably the funniest film ever made.
Yeah.
And it had a big impact on me as a kid. And, you know, but on the other hand, Sunset Boulevard is equally great. So again, it's idle to compare.
Right. Just watch all of Billy Wilder's movies.
Look at Avanti is a beautiful film. Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, The Apartment, etc.
Exactly. Can't go wrong. We at FlixWise are proclaiming 2015 to be the year of Orson Welles. This May would have been the centennial birthday for the legendary filmmaker, and we hope to find lots of reasons to talk about him in the coming months. There is definitely going to be a slew of screenings and celebrations leading up to the actual birthday, including the current retrospective going on right now at the New York Film Forum. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, that retrospective was programmed with the assistance of our guest, Professor Joseph McBride. So, how did you become involved with the Film Forum? Did they recruit you to help program the retrospective?
Yeah, I met Bruce Goldstein, who's the programmer at the Bologna Film Festival in Italy, which is called Cinema Ritrovato, which is about all, you know, bringing back older movies that have been restored or rediscovered or forgotten about or whatever, and they have wonderful programs. So I was there a couple of years in a row talking about Frank Capra and John Ford. We had retrospectives that I helped program. So I met Bruce, and he's a real maven of film. He's a real wonderful guy, and he's knows everything about films, and he's just great. So he asked me to help with this Welles retrospective that he was programming, but I was kind of consulting and suggesting films and helping him with one thing or another. And I'm introducing some of the films, several of the films, including Magnificent Ambersons and Touch of Evil. And I'm doing a program called Wellesiana, which is kind of a potpourri of unusual Welles things that I have. It's going to be a surprise.
Oh.
And then I'm doing an event with Chris Welles Fetter, who's Welles' oldest daughter, who lives in New York, and she was in the cast of his Macbeth, playing Macduff's child who gets murdered. And so she's going to appear with me with Macbeth, the restored Scottish version.
Very cool.
So, and she did a wonderful book on her father called In My Father's Shadow. And so we're going to do a public event with her, and that's going to be great.
Yeah. So talk about your personal history with Welles' filmography. What is it about his work that you admire?
Well, I've done three books on him, and, you know, I didn't realize when you start writing a book when you're young, it's going to become a lifelong job.
Yeah.
And people are always asking you to do another or update it, and you have to update the works. And so when I'm 90, I will be doing a book called Orson Welles, The Last Word, I'm sure. I'm saving material. His career is still going strong. He left so many unfinished works that he left a lot of jobs for us to do. And I think on some level he planned it that way, that he kind of thought, okay, I'll let all these people work on my stuff.
Right.
So The Other Side of the Wind is in progress. Finally, they have a deal, cross your fingers, that it may come out this year or maybe next year. You know, it's a lot of post-production needs to be done, but they finally cleared all the complicated legal problems.
Right.
And so I wrote three books on Welles over a long period of time. I started in 1966 when I was in college at the University of Wisconsin. I was already kind of a film buff, but I was planning to be a journalist and novelist, I guess. And I saw Citizen Kane in a film class, and I changed my whole life into becoming, you know, I wanted to write about films and then maybe make films. And it led me to become a screenwriter and write books about films. And so I started writing a book on Welles because I went out and tried to find a book on Welles to read, and there weren't any good ones that I could find. So I started writing this book, and I finished it pretty much by 1970, which is when I met Welles, and he put me in The Other Side of the Wind, playing a kind of spoof of myself as this sort of naive young critic and running around with all these people asking silly film buff questions. I'm supposed to be writing a book on John Huston, and I'm following him around, pestering him with questions right. that exasperate him. So I added a chapter about The Other Side of the Wind, and the book was published in 1972, and I updated that in 1996. I added 30,000 words because a lot had happened since then. We'd rediscovered certain films, and he made F for Fake and things like that, and I did another chapter on The Other Side of the Wind, and I'm going to revive that book. It's out of print now. I got the rights back to it, and I thought of putting it out in 2015, but I think what I'll do is wait till Other Side of the Wind comes out and then add a chapter really what is this film and analyzing it. Unless it gets delayed again, then I'll just right. put the book on. But I'll get that back into print. And then I did a book in 1977 called Orson Welles, Actor and Director, which was a short book for a series on Stars. And I said I'd like to do it on his acting career. This is the only book on his acting career. So I saw all the films that he acted in, except one or two I couldn't find. And a lot of them are really terrible. You know, he would do all kinds of films for the money, but there would be interesting scenes that he would do. So I would tell people at 59 minutes into the film, he appears for 2 minutes. My third book on Welles, I published in 2006. It was a hard one to do because I was covering a lot of stuff. It's called Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career. And I started it wanting to write about his last 15 years when he was in America. And he was making a lot of films, most of which haven't been finished, and they're kind of unknown to a lot of people. Like when he died, the New York Times said he had been inactive as a director for the last several years, which was ridiculous because he was shooting every day, and they had to retract that.
Right.
So I wrote this. A lot of the book is telling people what these films are and analyzing them because I've seen them all
right.
just about. And but then a third of the book is on The Other Side of the Wind and my experiences with him and what this film is about. And then I realized to talk about him as a purely independent filmmaker, which he became even before that term was commonly used, he had been independent from the beginning. And I owe this insight to my friend Douglas Gomery, who's a well-known film historian, who first proposed this idea that Welles was always an independent filmmaker. People think of him as a failed studio filmmaker because he made those two films for RKO and then a third one that was terminated and he got fired. But Douglas said that Welles was an independent filmmaker using the resources of a major studio briefly.
Right.
And he did that for a while. Then he moved down to Europe, and he became even more independent. And finally, he was making basically home movies,
right.
literally.
Right, yeah. So when people hear the name Orson Welles, they will typically either think about Citizen Kane or maybe his television appearances or perhaps his large personality, larger-than-life personality, or his equally large carriage. But that's really only a very, very small part of his career.
Yeah, he did so much. It's astounding. There's a book called This is Orson Welles that is an interview book with Peter Bogdanovich that Welles did. Jonathan Rosenbaum edited the book. And Jonathan did with Peter, a chronology of Welles' career. I did one back in my first book, which was 35 pages long, but they did 131 pages listing day-to-day everything he did throughout his lifetime creatively, and it's amazing. And they even left off some stuff, like they don't list his commercials, for example. That's sort of the last frontier of Welles right. scholarship that nobody will ever probably
no one wants find. To acknowledge that.
Some of them are lost.
Yeah.
Like he did one for a Mexican cement company and stuff, but he did a lot of commercials. But he worked in every medium. He did theater, radio, important work in both media. He did recordings, he did political speeches, he did a lot of writing, many other things, lectures, etc. And his career was astoundingly fertile, and yet people say he was this fat, lazy guy who just sat around, which is totally insane. He did enough for 10 lifetimes of an ordinary creative person.
Right.
And he made several of the greatest films ever made. So to limit his whole career to Citizen Kane and say he didn't do much after that is just totally wrong. So that's one reason I wrote my book. And as I say, to show how he became independent, I had to go back over his whole life or his creative career, and I kind of reapproached it from that perspective. And, you know, I wrote short things about his earlier films, but I wrote about his political career, how he got blacklisted, which I realized was true. Not everybody knows that. That's why he left America.
Is that why he had such a hard time getting projects made within the studio system?
Well, he was also not commercial. Jean Renoir, I think, said it best. He said Welles was an aristocrat. He couldn't help it, and he was working in a popular medium. Mm. And that's the basic conundrum. He was making films that were very sophisticated and advanced intellectually, and they were not designed for public popularity, even though I saw Welles at an LA Film Critics luncheon with King Vidor and Alan Dwan, and he turned to them and said, I wish I could have been like these men who were popular artists. He said, I wanted to be the American Charles Dickens when I started, who's kind of the epitome of the great popular artist. But he was not a popular artist, except in radio. That was the period where he was popular, and he connected with the audience, and that was his favorite medium. But in films, his films are always seen as highbrow art films, and so Hollywood didn't like him very much, didn't know what to make of him. And in 1947 is when the blacklist began, and he left Hollywood like right after the HUAC hearings. And he had been followed by the FBI since 1941 because of Kane. William Randolph Hearst was close to J. Edgar Hoover and got Welles followed, and they could never prove he was a communist because he wasn't. But he was a left-winger. He was supporting a lot of progressive causes that were considered, he would be called a fellow traveler in that the language of the time, you know. So he saw the handwriting on the wall and he left Hollywood. But he was in Red Channels, which is the Bible of the blacklist in 1950. It's this pamphlet that lists 151 people in the industry who, the authors, who were just some independent security consultants thought were communists.
Mm.
And if you were in Red Channels, you were blacklisted. It's prima facie evidence of being blacklisted. The only way to get out of it was to testify before HUAC and name names, or write a private letter, make some private deal with the studios or whatever. And I think Welles must have made a deal with CBS, because CBS was the only American company that would employ him in the United States until 1956. People don't realize that you don't have to testify before HUAC to be blacklisted. Mm. So when I tell people Welles was blacklisted, it's obvious to me. But the blacklist was not totally monolithic, too. You could occasionally get a job here and there.
Yeah.
But a lot of blacklisted people just couldn't get any jobs. But Welles's career was changed by it. He went to Europe and was working in European productions and made Othello with mostly his own money.
Was there anything in his films, anything thematically in his films that led people to believe that or suspect that he might be communist?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, Citizen Kane was a very radical film in a lot of ways. He was attacking William Randolph Hearst, who was a very powerful political force in America and media force, even though he was a bit weakened by that time. But it's Welles's films attack capitalism. Some people say there's a curse on Welles, voodoo curse resulting from his Brazilian film It's All True. But I say, yeah, there was a curse on Welles, but the curse was capitalism.
Mm.
And when I wrote that, I knew I'd get attacked for that. And sure enough, some publication attacked me for saying that. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true that he was an artist working in a capitalist medium. And he often said, you know, he was a painter, and to be a painter doesn't cost you anything. But if you're a filmmaker, you need $1 million or something to pay people, and you have to make a profit, and you have to advertise your film. And that's not the medium that was ideal for him. He said, I wish I had stayed in theater,
mm.
because some of those stage productions, like Julius Caesar, cost only $12,000. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
If he'd stayed in the theater, he could have kept going. But he said he fell in love with films, and he said it's the most expensive mistress a man could have.
Mm.
But his whole body of work is radical and anti-capitalist and anti authority. And, you know, Touch of Evil is a critique of police brutality, for example. It's very, very timely now.
Right, yeah.
But it's not, I mean, it's talking about what is a good policeman, what's a bad policeman. You know, a good policeman follows the law. He doesn't just act like an attack dog, as well as Charlton Heston says in the film. He's supposed to follow the law. So Welles's films are a critique of society, and they have all those elements that if you're a right-wing blacklister, you would think he's a commie, even though he was not a communist.
Right, right. He started off with such a splash, Citizen Kane. But what are the ways in which he grew as an artist? Was he someone who was constantly trying to push himself and grow?
Well, he was one of the things that is difficult for people with Welles, and it's true of Stanley Kubrick in a way too, that both of them died at the age of 70 and both had 12 released films in their lifetime. It's interesting. Mm. And yet Kubrick is not regarded as this tragic failure like Welles is for some people. To me, he's heroic success, even though he had a lot of problems. But Welles never did the same film twice. He was always trying new things. He was that kind of a experimenter, and his films are experimental, pushing the boundaries of what we think films are. Or Andrew Sarris said, Touch of Evil is a film that makes you rethink what a film should be, which is a wonderful comment. So he's always doing new things and new types of stories. He had many, many stories that he wanted to film that he couldn't film. On the radio, he did all different kinds of stuff. He was very eclectic. He had a wide range of interests. And so one of the problems is people always want him to do another Citizen Kane, and they would look at Lady from Shanghai and say, what is this, some film noir with a goofy film, and it's not Citizen Kane.
Right.
But we value that today because we're happy he made different kinds of films. Then he did Macbeth, which was, you know, he made a lot of Shakespeare works, but this was kind of a low-budget experimental Macbeth. And Kubrick did the same. If you look at his body of work, he never did similar films. They were always some departure. Welles believed in, he said this, in highbrow art and lowbrow art. He liked lowbrow entertainment like magic and vaudeville and things. What he didn't like was middlebrow art. And middlebrow art is, he said, what they give awards to.
Mm.
That's what Hollywood understands.
Yeah,
safe,
right.
conventional, but, you know, has a modicum of daring to it, you know, gentleman's agreement or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Stuff that doesn't date well. But Welles's films hold up well because they're original and iconoclastic. So people didn't know what to make of him, and they still don't. They still misunderstand a lot of what he did.
Right, right, yeah. And it's remarkable the same man who made Citizen Kane also made F for Fake. They're so, so different.
But it is wonderful that somebody will make different kinds of films. And we were talking about Billy Wilder, and he did that too. People would say, Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, what is this? You know, Witness for the Prosecution.
Right.
I mean, sometimes the films would be successful, but a lot of times they'd say, is this a Billy Wilder film? You know.
Right.
But that, to me, shows an artist of great range and depth. And by the way, Welles once referred to the wonderful Billy Wilder, which I think is nice that he appreciated
right.
him. And what other word could describe Billy Wilder?
There are many, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course.
But back to Welles. Legend goes that before Citizen Kane, Welles had absolutely little or no movie-making experience.
Not true.
Yes, which we, like, so what we'd always heard was that he watched Stagecoach however many times, 20-something.
Well, 40 is what he said.
40 yeah. times. And that taught him everything he knew, and then he went and made Citizen Kane. But that is not true at all, because you unearthed a short film, correct? Or you were, yeah.
Yeah, I found The Hearts of Age. I was tipped off by my film professor, Russell Merritt, from Madison, and he's now at Berkeley, and I saw him just recently, and I said, no, tell me, how did you find that film? He told me it was in the Greenwich, Connecticut Public Library, and I flew out there when I was a kid and watched this film and wrote about it and discovered this short film. Made in 1934, and Russell said, well, I lived in Greenwich. I hadn't known that, and so he found it at the library because he was around there. And So Welles was very upset that I found this film. Gary Graver, his cameraman, said about every 6 months, Welles would turn to him and say, why did Joe have to discover that film? Because he wanted us to believe that he was a virgin cinematically before he did Kane. And it's part of the legend of all filmmakers have what I call their creation myth about how they just lucked into filmmaking because they're such geniuses. And here's the guy who just makes Citizen Kane his first time off. And he said, I was so innocent and ignorant. And Greg Toland taught him everything about the camera.
Right.
And the stagecoach thing, when I met Welles, I said, I've seen Kane 60 times. And he was shocked. And he said, how could anybody watch any film 60 times? And I said, well, you watched Stagecoach 40 times before you made Kane, right? And he said, yeah, but I didn't just watch it. He said, every night at RKO for a month, I would watch the film with a different technician from a different department, like the costume person one night, the editor the next night, the musician, sound guy. And he said, we didn't just sit there and watch the film, we would talk all the way through it. And I would say, how did they do that and how did they do that? And that's a wonderful way to learn about film. So he needed, you know, some training, but recently rediscovered was Too Much Johnson, which was a very ambitious film he made in 1938. And it's a series of he was going to use it as three parts in a play to introduce acts of plays, of the play Too Much Johnson, which is a farce set in early 1900s in his version. And it's a marital sex farce. And the film was never shown. They had some problems, a lot of complications. And the play went on without the film, and the play was a debacle. But the footage was always thought lost, and it turned up in Pordenone, Italy, of all places where they have silent film festival. It was in a warehouse. It had been put in a warehouse in Rome under mysterious conditions, and then the warehouse went bankrupt, and it was sold to some warehouse in Pordenone, and some guy found it because the guy that ran the warehouse told this film buff who was working there, there's these stinking cans of film. We're going to throw them out unless you want them. And he opened them up, and he realized, this is Too Much Johnson. And in this film forum series we're doing, Bruce Goldstein is re-editing the footage again and doing a version of the play, like a reading of the play and all that, and trying to reintegrate it the first time it's ever been done, actually. And
that is very cool.
Yeah.
That's really neat. So if you happen to be in New York, make sure to check that out.
Yeah, it's an interesting retrospective. A lot of Welles's, all the films that he directed that were released in his lifetime, and some odds and ends, and then films he acted in. You know, a lot of films, well shown, good prints,
right,
at the Film Forum in New York.
That's very cool. So Chimes at Midnight is your favorite Welles film?
Well, actually, I'd say Magnificent Ambersons.
Ah, okay.
I did say Chimes at Midnight, but I love both of those films. I put them in my Sight and Sound list.
Okay.
Ambersons is my favorite film, partly, I just find it deeply emotional for reasons that I can't totally understand. There's something about the story that moves me a lot. Part of it is being from the Midwest, and it's about the Midwest, and it's sort of about the grandeur of the Midwest before industrialization came along and destroyed the old lifestyle, which obviously I wasn't old enough to know about, but it's very beautifully rendered in the film. And that's one of Welles' themes, is the loss of Eden, he always feels that there's kind of the modern world is not as good as it used to be, even though he realizes that's a myth, you know.
Right.
And he compared it to Merry Old England, which is the myth in Chimes of Midnight, that there's this wonderful time that gets destroyed by power and bureaucracy and everything. And they're very similar in that theme. And Ambersons, as is well known, was mutilated by the studio, and they cut 50 minutes out of it, and they reshot parts of it. So it's a film maudit, as the French say, a damned film. And I always have a soft spot for damned films.
Right.
And part of my goal in life is I want to go to Brazil to search for the missing Ambersons, because there is a rumor that Welles left a print of the long version down there.
Yeah.
And because the version, it's complicated, but it may or may not exist down there. And if I could find that, that'd be fabulous. But look, we found Too Much Johnson.
Exactly.
Who would have thought?
Exactly.
And then there are other films that Welles worked on when he was a boy. Pat McGilligan has a book coming out in May called Young Orson, which is a wonderful biography of his youth up to Kane. And he's done amazing research, and he's found out all kinds of things that nobody knows about Welles and his parents and his early creative endeavors and things like that, and his travels. And a lot of mythology surrounds Welles' youth, and Pat has nailed it down. And he's also found some additional evidence of film experimentation by Welles even before Hearts of Age. So Welles was dabbling in film. He was a film enthusiast, and he was tinkering with it. So he was, that's another big myth, that he just emerged full-blown with Kane. On the other hand, to make Kane was quite a leap from these little amateur films.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll still continue to print the legend.
Yeah.
Okay. but it sounds like it's shaping up to be a pretty good year for Welles fans. Like I said, we can now watch Too Much Johnson. Mm-hmm. We have this event at Film Forum, and hopefully we will get a chance to see The Other Side of the Wind.
There's also a book on The Other Side of the Wind by Josh Karp, which is coming out in April, which should be terrific. I've been helpful to him, and because I was in the film and I supplied him a lot of tips and leads, but he's found people I never even heard of that worked in the film, and he's sorted out as much as is humanly possible all the insane legal and financial tangle of this incredible saga.
Right.
So that should be a really interesting book. And Simon Callow's third and concluding volume of his biography of Welles may be out later in the year. So there's a book on the War of the Worlds coming out. So there'll be these books and a lot of festivals. I'm going to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where he was born, to give a speech in one of the grand old houses in his neighborhood where he grew up, where he was born. There's a house that's kind of like the Amberson house, and we're going to show Amberson's in the house.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is wonderful. And then I may go to Madison, Wisconsin, where he lived for a while, and my old hometown, and we may do something there. And then Barcelona, there's going to be a major Welles retrospective in April, in May and June, conference retrospective with people from all over the world. And he shot part of Chimes of Midnight there in an old cathedral, and they're going to show Chimes of Midnight in the cathedral.
If you happen to be in Barcelona,
if you happen to be there, drop
you
in.
Might want to stop it.
Yeah, exactly. Plenty of room in the cathedral.
And not to mention, we're going to have a special podcast on The Other Side of the Wind on closer to May 6th, Welles' birthday. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
I know you're busy jaunting around the world talking about Orson Welles, but before we end this podcast, I just want to give you an opportunity to give us a brief update on some of the projects you've been working on lately.
Yeah, I've been in 5 documentaries on Welles, and there are more coming. I was in Magician, Chuck Workman's documentary. I was in a French documentary by Clara and Julia Kupperberg, which is coming out on French television. And there are other ones that I'm in. But I teach at San Francisco State, grade a lot of papers. That's an interesting job. But I write books on the side always, and I'm working on one that deals with Ernst Lubitsch, who, the great German-American director who I love deeply. And he was the mentor of Billy Wilder, who we've been talking about. And so I'm dealing also in part with some of the other German-American directors who were influenced by Lubitsch, and also part of that diaspora of filmmakers who fled Hitler and came to America. People like Wilder, Max Ophuls, Douglas Sirk, a lot of great people. You know, the whole brain drain from Nazi Germany came to America. And Lubitsch had left before that. He was, as Wilder said, one of the lucky ones. He didn't have to flee. He was brought over in 1922 because he was a very prominent filmmaker in Germany. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this book is just to express my love for his work, but also just to see a lot of his films, because I was frustrated for decades that I couldn't see some of his films, especially the German ones. So I was the curator of a Lubitsch retrospective at the Locarno Film Festival in 2010, and we showed all the existing Lubitsch films. There are about 52 of his 72 films that exist. Some of the existing ones are only fragments, but we had the best prints from all over the world, and I curated that and helped with the brochure, and then the series went to the Cinémathèque Française, and so I got to see all the films on the big screen, and I had also gone to Munich to watch a lot of them, and then I went to Berlin last summer to where Lubitsch grew up, and I found his apartment, his family home, is still there. A lot of doors, doors within doors within doors. But it really means a lot to be in the neighborhood. It was an old Jewish neighborhood for many years, and then Hitler, you know, killed or shipped everybody out and massacred people there and everything. But now it's kind of a polyglot neighborhood, like a lot of Berlin, people from all over the world. But it has some of the flavor of the old days. And then I went to the Max Reinhardt Theater, where Lubitsch had apprenticed, and my intrepid researcher talked our way onto the stage. the guys who were the caretakers let us walk around the stage and turn the lights on, and it was really exciting.
Cool.
So I got a real flavor for the world he came out of. So I've been studying a lot of the history of Germany and the Weimar Republic and all that. It's a fascinating time, of course, in world history. The end of the Wilhelmine Empire and then the Weimar Republic, when all the ferment was going on, political and artistic, right. And then the coming of Hitler. And so it's a departure for me, because all my books have been about American filmmakers, although Capra was an immigrant. But, you know, I always felt I'm an American, that's my expertise, and it's a stretch for me to do another culture, but it's a challenge I wanted to take, and I found it very doable. I mean, you know, I can do a lot of research, and that's the fun part of writing.
Right.
So I've been getting into German culture and history a lot, and Jewish history, which I did with Spielberg to some extent. So it's been a real challenge and pleasure to be working on this book, and I'm making progress on it.
Oh, fantastic. Well, yeah. I'm sure you will let us know when it's ready.
Yeah, and we can do maybe a Lubitsch podcast.
Absolutely.
So many great films. I did a 22-minute talk on Design for Living on the Criterion Collection a couple of years ago. And I did the audio commentary on My Darling Clementine for Criterion recently, too. But I'll be doing more on Lubitsch, I'm sure, and so I'll be happy to talk about him.
Yeah, all right. Well, again, you'll have to just... I'm sure there will be plenty of opportunities for you to talk about Lubitsch on this show.
Well, thank you. You and I share a lot of common interests, and that's one of them.
Exactly.
And that's one reason I took you on as a TA, because I knew you loved Lubitsch and romantic comedies.
Precisely. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Do you want to give me a hard time for my atrocious Norma Desmond impression? Feel free to leave me a comment on our website, flickswise.com. Or if you just want to go on about how magnificent Gloria Swanson or Orson Welles are, you'll find a very receptive audience on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. However, since you made it this far, my terrible impression must not have driven you too far away. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and guess that you thought we did a pretty good job. Now, how about you go do us a solid and give us a good review on iTunes?
All you wonderful people out there in the dark.
Exactly. On our next show, we'll be back to our regularly scheduled sight and sound list with Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. Until we meet again, Professor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure, and I think you did a good Norma Desmond imitation.
Oh, thank you. I think you might be the only one, but we'll see. All right, enough of these words. Take care, everyone.